Okay. Today's subject is patriarchs of Jewish history. If we're going to speak about patriarchs of Jewish history, we need to first understand what this word history means. I'd like to share with you a story about a person that I believe nobody here has heard anything about. And I would contend that in a certain way, this individual had a greater impact than anybody else, perhaps in the 20th century. You could decide. How many of you have heard of somebody called Norman Borlaug, if I'm reading his name correctly? No. Okay. B-O-R-L-A-U-G. However you pronounce it. So let me tell you very quickly about this person who saved probably the lives of 1 billion, that's with a B, 1 billion people. And it happened in our lifetime, who are sitting right here. And the story is as follows, that this fellow Norman was born in 1914 in Iowa, and he studied plant pathology and genetics. And in 1944, the Rockefeller Foundation and the Mexico government hired him to develop a more productive strain of wheat, because they were dealing with something called stem rust, which is a fungal disease. And he decided that he has to do experiments on tremendously different altitudes, high up, I don't know how many thousand feet above sea level, and very low in different parts of the world. He kept on doing his experiments, and he developed a semi-dwarf, disease-resistant, high-output wheat that could grow almost anywhere in the world. He did this by taking certain wheats that were dwarfs and certain wheats that produced a lot of the top. And his break really came when he developed thick, short stems that could withhold very heavy grain at the top. At any rate, he was successful at doing this. He was so successful, in fact, that Mexico went from becoming an importer of wheat to an exporter of wheat. In 1963, he went to India and Pakistan, where severe hunger was rampant, and at first they didn't really want to listen to this stranger from America. But then in 1965, when 1.5 million people died, they decided, we're going to take this person's help, and he helped develop not just wheat, but other grains that they could grow there, and he taught them how to do it. In 1968, Pakistan was self-sufficient, and in 1970, India was almost self-sufficient. And one day, in 1970, while he was in the field doing this work, he got notification that he was to be awarded a Nobel Prize for his efforts of teaching people how to sustain themselves through planting grain and those kinds of crops. In 1984, he trained more than 1 million farmers in Africa, quadrupling the output of wheat and other cereal grain. And as of 2005, which is where my information goes until, he was 91 years old and still working at it. My point in all of this is that here we have a person who literally single-handedly, because of him, the estimates are that probably 1 billion people did not die of starvation and has shaped the world. So when we look at history, it can be often a single individual who does something that eventuates in something that is remembered throughout the world. I mention this at the beginning because where we are going to end today is noticing certain individuals where you have stories about what looks like their personal lives, but it eventuates in directing the world in a specific way. And to do this, to get to that point, I'd like to share with you something that I have here is a picture of a wall that stands outside the United Nations, and it's called the Isaiah Wall. I know you can't see the picture. You go to Google, click images, type in Isaiah Wall, and you'll get pictures, and you'll be able to read what passes around. What is written on this wall, it is the biblical quote, They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. In other words, there is a mission statement, if you like, or a vision that the United Nations has for the world. Now, regardless what we might think about the impotence of that organization, we really need to ask ourselves this question. You pass it around. Yeah. How did we get to this point when it wasn't too long ago that for so many millennia that was not what life was about? In general, we lived in this world, we meaning not us, but the peoples of the world, the rules of the jungle. And the rule of the jungle is that the fittest survive. Right makes might, and there's also one other thing that makes right. And that is, in Yiddish we have an expression, which means the one who has the dough tells you how it's going to go. Right? So we're talking about feudalism and those kinds of things. That's what it is. So how do we get from such a society the world over? And I must say, even though societies vary tremendously from one part of the world to the other, but in certain things they're all similar. And what we just described about social inequity and about war, they're basically all similar. We have welfare programs today of one type or the other in many places in the modern world, and they literally did not exist all over the world. There were other things which we're not really going to get into, but I just mentioned one point that's interesting, and to me it's a depiction of certain attitudes. Genghis Khan, when he died, he was buried with 40, I'm going to use a nice word now, unmarried women, okay, and 40 horses, okay? In other words, what was life and what was important and for people in different parts of the world? So what I'd like to suggest today with this presentation is two points that come together as one, and that is that the Jewish people's behavior as individuals and the Jewish teachings are really what brought the world to this point, that we could be at a point today where we in the world, at least officially, are seeking peace. Something which never happened in the history of the world. Just to put some perspective on that, in the 13th century, Nachmanides was put up for a debate in Spain against Pablo Cristiani. I believe it was 1272, whatever the date was exactly. One of the points that the Rambam made, we have that debate transcribed, because the Rambam transcribed it, we have that publication till today, where he said to them, you say you've come to bring peace in the world, but ever since you came along, meaning your religion, the poor were never exploited as much, and there was never as much war in the world. Never were the downtrodden stepped upon until you came to the scene. And on, what would he say since then? So, Jewish people's behavior and the Jewish teachings and all of this will trace itself back to one man. So, let's talk first about behavior of Jewish people, and then we'll talk about Jewish teachings. And to talk about the behavior of Jewish people, I would like to make two points. I'd like to read an excerpt which appears in an introduction to Roman Vizhniak's book, one of Roman Vizhniak's books with pictures of life in Europe. Here is a description of life in the 17th century. But the truth is, this picture is not only then, but it applies to the Jewish people in general, because what we're going to hear now, what I will read to you, comes from somewhere. It's actually our heritage. And essentially, if you exclude the poverty from this picture that we're going to read exists until this very day, and always did. Anyway, it says as follows. There was scarcely a Jewish house in all of the kingdom of Poland where its members did not occupy themselves with the study of Torah. Thus, there were many scholars in every community. With the coming of dawn, the members of the Chevra Tehillim, a group devoted to reciting Book of Psalms, would rise to recite Psalms for about an hour before prayers. Each week, they would complete the recitation of the entire Book of Psalms. And far be it that any man should oversleep the time of prayer in the morning and not go to the synagogue except under unusual circumstances. Never was a dispute among Jews brought before a Gentile judge or before a nobleman or before a king. And if a Jew took his case before a Gentile court, he was severely punished and chastised. All the six pillars, and I'm going to interrupt this quote for a minute and read a piece from Ethics of Our Fathers, the first Mishnah and the last Mishnah, and I'm going to start off with the last. The last Mishnah reads, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, Al Shloish Advar Ma'olam Kaim, on the world endures by virtue of three things, Al Hadin, justice, and please remember this point because this is one of the big points that I extracted for my presentation, but it will be mentioned at the very end, Val Ha'emes, and untruth, to administer truth, Val Ha'shalom, and peace. Shenemar, as it says in the verse, Emes u'mishpat v'shalom shifts b'shareichem, as it says in the biblical verse, administer truth and the judgment of peace in your gates. The first Mishnah states that the last member of the men of the Great Assembly, this is the beginning of the Second Temple period, stated, Al Shloish Advarim Ha'olam Oimed, the world stands on three things, Al HaTorah, Al Avodah, Al Gnes Chasadim. On the study of Torah, the service of God, and the deeds of kindness. Okay, quotes, and we're going to see how true this is. So back to the quote. All of the six pillars, the six we just mentioned now from those two Mishnahs, upon which the world rests, were in existence in the Jewish community of the Kingdom of Poland. There were many who lived in appalling poverty, and many who were pinched by never-ending worries. And there were plenty of taverns with strong spirits, but drunkards were never seen among Jews. When night came and a Jew wanted to while away his time, he did not hurry to take a drink. He went rather to his books or joined a group that, either with or without a teacher, gave itself over to the pure enjoyment of study. Physically worn out by their day's toil, they sat over open volumes and intoned the austere music of the Talmud. Poor Jews, whose children knew only the taste, as one of the songs has it, of potatoes on Sunday, potatoes on Monday, potatoes on Tuesday, sat there like intellectual princes. They possessed whole treasuries of thought, the knowledge, ideas, and sayings of the many ages. When a problem came up, there was immediately a crowd of people to offer opinions, proofs, quotations. One raised a question on a difficult passage in Maimonides' work, and many vied in an attempt to explain it, outdoing one another in the subtlety of dialectic distinctions. The stomachs were empty, the houses overcrowded, but the minds were replete with the riches of the Torah. That's one portrayal. Another portrayal, and I have to say that I did try to get the actual quote of what I'm going to mention to you now. I could not, so I'm going to do it from memory. But if you do want to find this quote, I do know where to get a hold of it, and it's not online. At any rate, during the Black Plague in the 14th century, a monk, I believe, wrote a letter to his superiors describing the scene of where he was living. And in it, he describes how people want to have nothing to do with each other. Because if you look at a sick person, you're going to get sick, let alone if you go help them, then of course you're going to get sick. Every man became unto himself. Somebody fell down in a faint, that was his end. And he describes it poetically, if you can say such a thing. And then he goes on to describe Let's remember who's writing here and in which time. During the Black Plague, the Jews were accused of poisoning the wells and all sorts of things. We've mentioned this at Tashlich many times. And there were many pogroms because of it. He describes the Jewish people during the plague, how when somebody is sick, how everybody comes and they visit the sick and they help. And when people die, it's the only place where a person died and they got buried right away. Nobody wanted to touch a dead body and get sick and die themselves. So this behavior of the Jewish individuals, how it was noted by the people amongst whom they lived. The Jews were particularly noted at that point for another thing, doesn't really relate to our discussion, but I'll mention it because it's very interesting. Jewish people died at approximately, at least those who were there, say, about half the rate. We know today that Yiddishkeit requires us to wash our hands so many times and wash ourselves. We have to take a bath for Shabbos. I mean, who took a bath every week? Nobody. Okay? And we have to wash our hands after going to the washroom and so on and so forth. And not only that, since, at the very least, we can prove archaeologically, since the time of King David, you'll excuse me, everybody, we had an amazing thing. We had public washrooms. And by Jewish law, we have to behave a certain way, not like others behave, which I believe you know. At any rate, back to our point. Here is how some of this attitude translates until today. What is the last point of contact for Jews to Judaism in the world today? And I'm going to speak mainly about North America because it's where the greatest portion of Jews live, but it's elsewhere as well. It's not Yom Kippur and it's not a Pesach Seder. Believe it or not, is giving money to the third largest charity in the world, the United Jewish Appeal. Now, we have to hear that. What percentage are we even of this population? All right?
Could you repeat that?
Yes. What I said, the last point of contact for Jewish people here is giving money to the UJA, which is the third largest charity in the world.
The last
thing Jewish of any shape or form that they will do is not being buried as a Jew, not getting married as a, etc. The last Jewish anything is giving money to the UJA. That's literally the last point. And once they stop doing that, they're out of the scene. Literally, that is the... Isn't that something? Now, this comes from somewhere. It comes from this fact, which was alluded to in the quote before about the pillars upon which the world stands, and one of them was kindness. There never was a Jewish community of any reasonable size without an interest-free loan organization and without countless, what we would call today, welfare or social assistance organizations. Those things are new in civilization today, but for us, they are literally as old as our history. That is a fact. Yeah. No, I don't. Oh, it's a changer. But I want to make sure you hear what's going on. Right? Okay. Yeah. All right. As a matter of fact, even when Jews were their poorest, when the Jews of Russia were all picked up one day by the wonderful Tsar and shipped over to this place called the Pale of Settlement, fully one quarter of those people lived off the contributions of the remaining three quarters of the poor population. Okay? So, this is about the individual life of the Jew. But does this really affect the world to the point that we're suggesting? So let's listen to this quote from Maimonides. This was discovered in an old copy of Maimonides in Yemen, where Christian censorship never reached, because Christianity didn't take a hold over there. Because Otherwise, all other books were subject to censorship, and we know how many things were changed and taken out. This is the very end of the Laws of Kings, the end of the Rambam's 14 books, in which he goes through all of the 613 commandments, the only one who did it, and he speaks, how will we know when the Mashiach is here, what's it going to be like, and so on and so forth. Here is the quote that relates to what we're talking about today. Now, I'm going to read exactly as he wrote. I don't like to say some of these words, but I'm going to now. Jesus of Nazareth, who aspired to be the Mashiach and was executed by the court, was also alluded to in Daniel's prophecies. As it states, the vulgar among you, the vulgar among your people shall exalt themselves in an attempt to fulfill the vision, but they shall stumble. Can there be a greater stumbling block than Christianity? All the prophets spoke of Mashiach as the Redeemer of Israel and their Savior, who would gather their dispersed and strengthen their observance of the mitzvot. In contrast, Christianity caused the Jews to be slain by the sword, their remnants to be scattered and humbled, the Torah to be altered, and the majority of the world to err and serve a God other than the Lord. Nevertheless, and this is the kicker, as they say, nevertheless, the intent of the Creator of the world is not within the power of man to comprehend, for his ways are not our ways, nor are his thoughts our thoughts. Ultimately, all the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth and that Ishmaelite, he's speaking about Muhammad, of course, and for most of his life that's where he lived in those lands and was fleeing from some of them as well. And that Ishmaelite who arose after him will only serve to prepare the way for Mashiach's coming and the improvement of the entire world, motivating the nations to serve God together, as it states in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9. I will transform the peoples to a purer language, that they all will call upon the name of God and serve him with one purpose. And then he goes on. As it relates to us, what we are being told here by the Rambam, who lived at the time of the Crusades, he was the doctor of Saladin, who was taking the charge for the Muslims. What we are hearing from him is that through the spread of Torah in a way that is totally bastardized, if you might say, ultimately this is God's plan to bring about the coming of Mashiach. As a matter of fact, let me now read to you a quote in the Torah portion of Eschanan, the second portion, Sheni, and it says, I'll read it just in English. See, I have taught you decrees and ordinances as Hashem, my God, has commanded me. This is Moses speaking before he's about to die. To do so in the midst of the land to which you come to possess it. You shall safeguard and perform them. And listen to the next words. You should safeguard and perform them, for it is your wisdom and discernment in the eyes of the people, who shall hear all these decrees, and who shall say, surely a wise and discerning people is this great nation. For which is a great nation that has a God who is close to it, as Hashem our God, whenever we call upon him? And which is a great nation that has righteous decrees and ordinances? Let me repeat those words. And which is a great nation that has righteous decrees and ordinances? We're talking about law. One of the pieces I pulled out, but we'll mention at the very end. Such as the entire Torah that I place before you this day. And then it goes on to say how we must keep it, and we must, in verse 10, and they shall teach their children. So in other words, way back in ancient times, we're talking now 3,300 years ago, just a little under, the Almighty is already saying that the Torah of this small, humble people in a desert who will forever remain small, this is going to be a teaching that will influence the world. At that time, we would look at it and we'd say, sweet dreams. Today, we see how true, obviously, the Almighty is. And a person who was truly an atheist, Mark Twain, wrote an essay called Concerning the Jews, and I'm going to read one sentence. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. Because the Almighty, I'm continuing now, the Almighty decreed that the Jew is to be the moral conscience for the world. And I'd like now to read, again, not the word of a Jewish person, but this book, Paul Johnson's A History of the Jews, and this is the paperback edition, the hardback edition is much bigger and thicker, a book of more than 600 pages. I'd just like to read some quotes from his prologue and his epilogue. And let's hear what he has to say. Why did he write this book? And this book, by the way, became a national bestseller. How a Jewish history book becomes a national bestseller, New York Times, for 3 months is also a miracle. But here it is. My third reason, meaning for writing this book, was that Jewish history covers not only vast tracts of time, but huge areas. The Jews have penetrated many societies and left their mark on all of them. And this is what he is going to establish in his book. Writing a history of the Jews is almost like writing a history of the world, but from a highly peculiar angle of vision. It is a world history seen from the viewpoint of a learned and intelligent victim. We then continue down the page. Finally, the reason for writing this book, the book gave me a chance to reconsider objectively, in the light of a study covering nearly 4,000 years, the most intractable of all human questions. What are we on earth for? I'd like to interject here that for most of the history of the world, people had to just survive, have what to eat. Is history merely a series of events whose sum is meaningless? Is there no fundamental moral difference between the history of a human race, of the human race, and the history, say, of ants? Or is there a providential plan of which we are, however humbly, the agents? No people has ever insisted more firmly than the Jews that history has a purpose and humanity a destiny. At a very early stage in their collective existence, they believed they had detected a divine scheme for the human race, of which their own society was to be a pilot. They worked out their role in immense detail. They clung to it with heroic persistence in the face of savage suffering. And then he goes on to say, the Jewish vision became the prototype for many similar grand designs for humanity, both divine and man-made. The Jews therefore stand right at the center of the perennial attempt to give human life the dignity of a purpose. Okay. So, and where did this begin? Where did all of this begin? We could say it began at Mount Sinai, where the Almighty gave the Jewish people the Torah. But the story did not begin there, because the Jewish people got to Sinai from somewhere. They got there from Egypt, the Exodus of Egypt. But how did they get to Egypt? For that, we need to go backwards to how, in the story of Isaac, he and his children, 70 souls, came down to Egypt. But it doesn't begin there, because Jacob came from Isaac. And Isaac came from Abraham. And where did Abraham come from? So here is the story of Abraham. Because let's please remember how we started. About one man, by devising a strain of wheat, saved the lives of a billion people. That's real history, even though nobody knows his name. That's real history. Let's talk about this one man, the patriarch of history, and all patriarchs of history are simply outgrowths of him, including his son and grandson, Isaac and Jacob. Because there was a man named Terah, who was an idolater. And because of a whole story, we're not going to go into it now, when Abraham was born, he hid him in a cave for 3 years. And when he came out of the cave, he saw the world for the first time. And where did this come from? And he had this remarkable idea that he came to the conclusion that there must be a single invisible God who is all-powerful, you can use the word infinite if you like, who created all of this. And because, this is the key, because he found God, God chose him. You see, the Jewish people are the chosen people for what? Well, not for misery, even though we seem to have been chosen for it, but we've been chosen to do exactly what we're speaking of today, to teach the world its purpose. And this began because there was a man called Noah, and he was most righteous, and God saved him, but he didn't go out there teaching people there was a God in the world. When Abram came to the conclusion there's a God in the world, he made it his business to teach that there is a God in the world. So if so, God said, you know what? You are going to be the beginning of the fulfillment of the purpose of the world. So God chose Abraham and his descendants to give life purpose and to give life meaning. And therefore, I'd like to read now from the end of his book, just a quote, not the whole thing, of the epilogue. So now that he's written all of his book for those four reasons, here is part of his conclusion. One way of summing up 4,000 years of Jewish history is to ask ourselves, what would have happened to the human race if Abraham had not been a man of great sagacity, or if he had stayed in Ur and kept his higher notions to himself, and no specific Jewish people had come into being? Certainly, the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. Humanity might have eventually have stumbled upon all the Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. All the great conceptual discoveries of the intellect seem obvious and inescapable, like peace being a universal objective, which the world only just discovered, once they have been revealed. But it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe, and now you're going to hear some of the components that I had to extract for the sake of time from this presentation and alluded to. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human, of the sanctity of life. Remember the 40 maidens buried with Genghis Khan, right? Just one little example of thousands. And the dignity of the human person. What does it say in the beginning of the Torah? The man is created in God's image. Every man, right? The dignity of the human person. Of the individual conscience, and so of personal redemption. Of the collective conscience, and so of social responsibility. Right? Of peace as an abstract ideal, and love as the foundation of justice, and many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind. Without the Jews, it might have been a much emptier place. Above all, the Jews taught us how to rationalize the unknown. The result was, and this is what the Jews really gave to the world, the result was monotheism and the three great religions which profess it. It is almost beyond our capacity to imagine how the world would have fared if they had never emerged. Nor did the intellectual penetration of the un... That's it. Okay, we'll stop. I'm sorry. We stopped there. And he goes on and on. Now, is he the only opinion who says so? Because maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. Let's take a look at some other people. And we're going to choose only Gentiles this time. And I'm going to give you a copy. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But just one or two quotes, and then I'll pass these around. You can read them in your own time. It's fascinating. Here is a quote, Winston Churchill, the person who refused to bomb the train tracks to the concentration camps as much as the Jews impressed upon him the need to do so. Here's what he wrote. Some people like the Jews and some do not. But no thoughtful man can deny the fact that they are beyond any question the most formidable and the most remarkable race which has appeared in the world. Here is the John Adams, the second president of the United States. I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of the other sect who believe or pretend to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to persevere and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality and consequently of all civilization. That is our patriarch, Abraham. Here is one more, and that's it. This is by Blaise Pascal, Frenchman, I believe. It is certain that in certain parts of the world, we can see a peculiar people separated from the other peoples of the world, and this is called the Jewish people. This people is not only of remarkable antiquity, but has also lasted for a singularly long time. We should note something that we all take for granted. We are the oldest single people of the world still around. For whereas much as the people of Greece and Italy, of Sparta, Athens and Rome, and others who came so much later have perished so long ago, these still exist, despite the efforts of so many powerful kings who have tried 100 times to wipe them out. This is before Hitler, mind you. And their historians testify. And as can be easily be judged by the natural order of things over such a long spell of years, they have always been persevered. However, their preservation was foretold. My encounter with this people amazes me. Where was their preservation foretold? Right here in the Torah, that we're all going to be here. So let's bring this down to the conclusion, and then we'll pass these around. We have a patriarch called Abraham who brought monotheism and everything that emanated from it to the world. But, as we mentioned before, this came about through the personal behavior of Jews. Because ultimately Christianity, however it spread through the world, it came to a point where Christians are learning to behave in accordance with what they think is their own teachings through the example of Jewish people who lived in their midst. What this means for you and I is that this is the way you and I play our role as individuals in the journey of mankind, extending from creation to the fulfillment of what it says on the Isaiah wall, which of course is talking about the coming of Mashiach, that we will come to a time where nation will not lift up sword against nation and will not learn war anymore. So every one of us, we have a great patriarch, but you and I as single individuals are the ones who carry his message until the coming of Mashiach, which should be speedily in our times. Thank you.
All right.